I strongly believe that misconceptualizing the world as is being done has tremendous damage both socially and ecologically. So we have to reconceptualize how we understand. And this is reconceptualizing not just in terms of the academic, but the academic has to feed into the practice. So my concern is, how do we take the ideas from, like my book is very philosophical and academic, and move them into practices? But my thrust is to change economics. So, you know, my real push is that economists are actually misleading the world into a total disaster, and they should not be pretending that they're doing anything different, and that we need to make this very, very obvious to everybody.
Those things. So when one thing changes, another thing changes.
The gross national product does not allow the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play.
Hello and welcome to Invisible Handcuffs, a podcast that seeks to expose the economic ideology underpinning our crises and explore ways we can free ourselves from its chains. My name is Katie Shields, and I am a recovering mainstream economist and your host. Why does having a shared understanding of reality matter in the fight to reclaim economics? That is the topic of this week's discussion, where I'm joined by Clive Spash, a social ecological economist whose most recent book calls for a revolution in economic thought. This discussion brought a whole new language to problems I've sensed but been unable to put into words. Because one of the key pushbacks I often get when I critique mainstream economists is that they are doing impartial, objective science. Yet Clive refutes such arguments, drawing on concepts from philosophy of science, that is, the theory of how knowledge is produced. Just because you have a complex mathematical model, or you've done a survey or produced a graph, does not mean you're doing science. What economists are often doing is applying a particular method, regardless of whether that actually makes sense. That is, what assumptions it's based on, what conception of reality. We discuss this in relation to one common approach that involves asking people how much they'd be willing to pay to save a certain species or a river or a forest. But this framing already has a hidden bias that we ought to pay to keep something, not be compensated for our collective loss. It also implies that environmental protection is a matter of individual preference, not our collective survival. So in this sense, it is the wrong method based on a flawed conception of reality that treats the environment as an endless resource that we can choose to protect or not. So what could a better economics look like? Well, it would have a better conceptualization of reality, for a start, what Clive calls critical realism. This requires drawing on many disciplines, including other heterodox thought schools and sources of knowledge. So that might include recognizing Earth's biophysical limits, the laws of thermodynamics, as well as power relations and the injustices of the existing capitalist system. It would also incorporate a common ethics to ensure economic models do not produce the same injustices. Whether we're talking about solidarity economics, donut economics, well-being or degrowth, these are practices, approaches. But in order for them to contribute to genuinely viable alternatives, they need to be grounded in science. This is where Clive hopes social ecological economics can come in. Not as an additional thought school, not a buzzword, but a unifying social science that can pose a genuine alternative to the outdated and truly unrealistic economics taught and practiced across schools and academia today. I'll provide links to Clive's website and textbook in the show notes. With that, please join me in welcoming economist Clive Spash. Welcome, Clive. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Really happy that we're able to get this set up, despite having been in the same city for quite some time, and I didn't manage to get an interview with you when you were in Vienna. You're now up in Norway now. Can you remind me where you are, actually?
Yeah, I'm in an eco-village, actually, in Hudal. It's about an hour north of Oslo. Okay. So it's basically the only eco-village in Norway, although there's some which are set up as farms and communities, which are pretty close, you could say.
And you are, I mean, you're an ecological or a social ecological economist, I should say, and I'd love to hear more about that today. But something I've noticed, so now that I've been researching for this series, your name has come up more and more. I had John Harvey on a couple of weeks ago. John has written a book on contending perspectives, and he cited your work under ecological economics. But I have to admit, you know, as I was getting into this field, I hadn't heard of you as much as maybe some other names that we might talk about later, like Kate Raworth or Tim Jackson. Is there a reason for that?
I mean, one of the issues is, of course, how you communicate and whether you want to be populist or not. Mm. I'm an academic researcher and I'm dedicated to my science and I do things in depth and I look for coherence and I'm communicating not to the general public. It's not my aim. My aim has been to reform the economics profession from within and necessarily without. And also to be an activist, an academic activist.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you, and I'd love to get into this a little bit more, is because of the approach that you take in your book, and I have it in front of me, and it's all dog-eared, because it's been taking it with me on trains and so on. Foundations of Social Ecological Economics, The Fight for Revolutionary Change in Economic Thought. And I think for me, this was what was really illuminating, is that you do get into the philosophy of science. But before we get into that, how did you get, though, to where you are? I presume you didn't sort of wake up and think, I need to reform economic thought, or where did you start?
Well, I mean, it's a reasonably long process, we could say. I mean, initially I was environmentalist before I was an economist, which maybe is not unusual in one sense, because economics, it wasn't addressing the environment at all when I was young. So, you know, I was engaged in conservation and conservation movements from World Wildlife Fund when I was like 10 years old doing fundraising and through to Sea Shepherd when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, so whale activism and so on and so forth. So when I was doing my undergraduate, I was kind of lucky that I ended up in one of the only universities that had one of the only two professors looking at environment and economics, which was Nick Common. And I could actually study something on the environment, which was becoming a bigger issue. And the thing that those days was that, you know, it was campaign for nuclear disarmament. So nuclear weapons was a big issue. And that was a really big concern. But everybody was campaigning against that, it seemed like, you know. And then when you came to the environment, it was basically a natural science issue. There was hardly anything going on the social sciences and certainly not on the economics. So having specialized in economics, I was concerned then to address the environment. And I actually thought it would be very straightforward and simple and that we would stick a tax on and I would be unemployed and the whole thing would be solved, right? Because that was what you were basically educated. Oh, it's very simple. It's just a market failure. Get the prices right and everything will be perfect, you know. And here we are 40 years later, and the same rhetoric is going round and round. So I got into studying air pollution and air pollution impacts and started to realize information was being suppressed. You know, the Coal Electricity Generating Board in those days had full knowledge of their transmission of long-range pollutants to Scandinavia, creating acid rain, but the information was suppressed. There were private internal reports. They didn't want to admit it internationally. So then you start getting into the political economy aspects, you know. Mm. So then I basically specialized in environment and economic issues. And in those days, it was a very small field, I would say, mostly in North America, and also very mainstream in terms of the economic outlook, despite the fact that a lot of what people were coming up with in the 60s and 70s was actually totally critical of mainstream thought.
People that were coming up within the field of economics or outside of the field of economics?
This is the amazing thing. So normally what happens is you get 1972, Meadows Report, a bunch of people who don't know anything about economics. Oh, that's awful. And actual fact, when you look at the literature, if anybody ever bothered to do it, they would find that there was a whole range of critiques of growth from the 1960s onwards, actually even earlier. So you have Kapp, 1950, he wrote his first book on the environment and economics. You have Sarasi Wantra, 1952, conservation, talking about that. You have the Resources for the Future set up in Washington, D.C., which is a major research center that is aimed at looking at resource and environmental issues. They start doing environmental economics research on environmental problems. Starting in 1962, you have the travel cost method, Clawson and Kretsch. You start getting development of a whole range of ideas. By the time you get to the late 60s, you've got E.J. Mishen publishing his book on the problems of economic growth, the cost of economic growth. You've got 1970, 71, you've got Georgescu Rogan publishing a major book on entropy and economic process. You get Herman Daly in The Steady State. Now, the idea that it's not economists, that it's somebody outside economics, is totally fallacious, absolutely fallacious. And the amount of work that was then going on, so my supervisor, Ralph Dodge, was already working on climate change before Nordhaus was even paying any attention to the issue. There was a major report going on in the United States, like the IPCC report, you know, six volumes with a major volume on economics. You know, the field was actually very, very critical of the approaches. And this was coming from economists. You've got ideas of, you know, social metabolism arising, materials balance theory, Keynes, Ayres, Dodge, all of these people were inside economics, working as economists in the field, and producing work that was highly critical.
So what's your, I don't know if you also, if you know my works, I've also looked into the Meadows Report, and my previous podcast was an in-depth look at that and the history. Spoke also with Dennis Meadows and Jürgen Randers, and had a memoir from Daniela Meadows as well to use. And I know that they were also quite surprised at the pushback initially, particularly because they'd been interacting with lots of different scientists and they didn't think they were really seeing that much that was new. So lots of institutions, and as well, you know, particularly working with people like Herman Daly. But there was by then, and maybe my take on this is wrong, so feel free to correct me, but there was by then already starting to be a split, was there not? I mean, you had, and there was a lot of pushback by the economists at MIT, for example, then Robert Solow and people that were very pro-growth. So there was maybe it was less divided than it is now. Maybe is that, or would you, you know, how would you?
I mean, we could say yes and no. So the economics profession in those days, there was no heterodoxy versus orthodoxy because it was one profession, and you were trained to understand across the board different schools of thought. So this dichotomy that comes later is much harder and faster. But when you look at it from the inside, there were clearly major divisions. So the tolerance of economists who actually criticized the mainstream was pretty low amongst certain schools of thought. But, you know, there's a whole history around the Mont-Pelerin Society and the pushback. So the history of economics is actually quite interesting. You know, there was a domination of institutional economists in the early part of the 20th century, and they were leading things like the American Economic Association. So there's a deliberate and planned and strategic pushback of these positions and an empowerment of people who are what will now be called neoliberal, but actually it's neo-Austrian economists, totally pro-market, anti-regulation, usually anti-communist, and quite explicitly so in many circumstances. And they regard communism as being anything to do with regulation by government. You know, so what you have, people like Solow, Samuelson, the mathematical economists, are basically supporting capitalism and have no problem with capitalism at all. And what they see as the problem is anything that comes in that threatens regulation. So when you get to be like Nordhaus, who's a second generation of these, you know, he's a student from these same people. He is just reproducing the same pro-growth arguments. So when they get to the environment, their strategy is, oh yeah, let's talk about environmental problems and then belittle them, conceptualize them in a mathematical model so that they become totally harmless and meaningless. And that's basically what's been done. So, you know, when you, I mean, someone like Georgescu Rogan is extremely interesting, right? Because he is a leading mathematical economist. He's lauded by people like Samuelson. He's given an award from the American Economic Association as a leading light in the field. And then he changed sides. He basically realizes that what he's doing cannot address the environment, that it doesn't have anything about qualitative change, that entropy and thermodynamics requires that you understand quality, that most of the conceptualizations that you have in mathematical models turn them into metaphors, and therefore they don't actually relate to the object of study. And what happens to him? He gets ostracized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He gets belittled, ostracized, chucked out. So you get to the stage where, you know, I think a few years ago there was an article in, I think it was the New York Times, which claimed that Georgeska Rogan wasn't an economist.
Yeah.
These people who were not economists. I mean, this is somebody given an award by the American Economic Association who was lauded by Samuelson. And now apparently he's not an economist, you know.
Yes, I'd like to get in then a little bit to that split, because and maybe we can do this together. So defining what you term ecological economics or social ecological economics, and maybe we can also for listeners, because I studied environmental economics, so more in the Nordhaus vein, and didn't discover the alternatives later because, like you said, they ended up being suppressed. So can you sort of describe what your field is and also help us understand the difference between social ecological economics, environmental economics?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, when I was starting, there was no ecological economics. There was only environmental and resource economics.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this field developed in response to initially resource problems. So in agriculture, things like the Dust Bowl, the economists were promoting production processes without paying any attention to, in that case, soil fertility and soil structure. So the concerns over the environment really start in the 1930s, we could say, with the economists, where they start realizing that they have to pay attention to the structure. So it's actually, you look at it, many of the people who developed environmental economics started in agricultural economics. So they're looking at agricultural systems. This also leads you into concerns about water and water resources. But the orientation of economics in agricultural economics and from that period is all about production and production processes. How do we produce something and how do we do it efficiently, where efficiency is defined in very narrow terms about increasing production with minimizing inputs. So the orientation of it is all about optimal production. How much can we produce the most benefit at the least cost, which is basically cost-benefit analysis. So the thrust of the field is that we need to look at things optimally. So it's very much an engineering approach. And this also adopts into mathematics. So you get a combination of the scientific approaches to create mathematical models, the aim being to maximize production and minimize costs. So that's environmental economics. It then slots the environment into this as a variable. So typically in production processes, they say that it's land, labor, and capital. And land, for the environmental economists, is then seen as being an inadequate conceptualization of the environment. So they try to improve it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that as they improve their understanding of reality and try to put it into the model, they realize it doesn't work. So even though those people are within a mainstream economic approach, which is about mathematics, optimization, creating a wider understanding of what this land variable is in their models, they actually open up a box to a whole range of other things, which is where the tensions and the problems arise. So environmental economics becomes actually quite radical, and it's recognized as such explicitly by people like Knaes, Ayres, Darche, and others. And they start to realize that pollution, which is treated in mainstream economics as a single instance of a market failure that just requires us to get the prices right,
mm-hmm.
is actually all pervasive. And they also recognize that the way that economists in environmental economics are treating this is as a two-actor problem. There's a polluter and there's the pollutee. And then the Chicago School says, oh, well, we don't need government. They can just talk to each other. And then the whole problem solved. Or we can just have private property rights, the whole problem solved. Everybody just negotiates. So there is no problem. So they get rid of the problem by actually reducing it down. But the environmental economists are like, hey, no, look, wait a second. This is not about two actors in a simplistic model. This is all pervasive pollution. What that means is that everything that we're doing creates a pollution impact.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? It means that if you take the mainstream economist approach of internalizing the externalities, that is, calculating the damages in monetary terms and making the polluter pay, for example, mm-hmm. you'd have to actually include every single thing that is produced would have a different price. Everything has a different price. All the prices in the economy are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That means you've now entered into the realm of central planning. So what you're actually doing is you are planning the economy because all the prices are wrong. So some economist now has to recalculate all the prices. This is, of course, is a total horror for the free market economists and the American capitalists, because what they're doing is the environmental economists have now come to the conclusion that pollution is all pervasive. The economic model that they're using is flawed. Mathematics doesn't help you. Optimization can't be done. And what we need is government intervention on a very large scale to address pollution problems. So environmental economics is actually now shifted into a revolutionary paradigm shift. And that has to be denied. That's why ecological economics emerges, because so many people are in the field who know this, who are pushed out, that mm-hmm. they actually decide to formulate a new organization, which will allow them to express what they want, which requires setting up a new journal, a new society, a new thrust into a way that is not being controlled by the gatekeepers of mainstream economics.
So this was the evolution then of ecological economics. And when did that happen? Approximately?
So this is happening from the mid-1980s onwards, and then the formalization of the society is around 88, 89, and the journal set up just a little bit after that, with actually a major conference in Washington, D.C. I was there, the World Bank, because Herman Daly was there at the time, you know. So this is also quite interesting that that happened. But I could just say a little, I could maybe briefly just say about social ecological economics. So
yes,
the social ecological economics is because what happened when that disaffection and reorientation occurred is that mm-hmm. there was a funny mixture, if you like, of people. So you had people, I call them the dissenters from the orthodoxy, right? So you've got the orthodox mainstream, which is the hardcore with the Solo and, you know, the Nordhaus type people. And then you've got these dissenters. So these, and there's a spectrum of these people who are really not sure how far they should push things. And they tend to back off a lot. Mm-hmm. So these orthodox dissenters are opening up the box saying, well, actually, this is wrong, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you've got half of them going back in again and saying, OK, we'll just forget about that entropy stuff and whatever. And then you've got the real radicals, more like Georgescu Rogan, who says, OK, this is all wrong. The theory is all wrong, and who move away. So what you get is that social economists, like, so my supervisor, Ralph Dodge, would have been an orthodox dissenter. He was always going back into the mainstream. But if you ever read the introduction to the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management, which was the mainstream journal, it's actually totally about social issues. It's about, it mentions culture, qualitative analysis. It talks about a whole range of aspects which the mainstream really hate. So the aim, even within the environmental economics, was to bring the social aspects, the cultural aspects into the field and qualitative analysis. And in ecological economics, this was a very strong current. And you had something of a division between the North American threads of the ecological economics, who were very keen on the optimization approaches, even amongst ecologists, and the Europeans, who brought in a lot more radical alternative thinkers who were people who were critical of economics, but not economists formally. So there's a combination of what we call social ecological economists, because people coming from very diverse disciplines, they could be Marxists, feminists, sociologists, applied philosophers, and so on, who join in to create a new field, which is much broader and interdisciplinary. And that's the social ecological economics, I'd say.
Okay, and so you mentioned there the kind of dissenters, and this has continued, though, if I understand, this is something that I took away as well from your book. There's continued to be a kind of mix of methods, incoherence, I think, as you put it. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe we can also get on here as well to the importance of bringing in a philosophy of science to social and ecological economics.
So I think what you end up with is that there's, as I say with the subtitle of the book, is there's a fight, right? There's a fight going on between different perspectives and different understandings. And there's a lot of ideological positions preloading this, and different understandings about what an economic system is even. So when you get to kind of trying to understand why are people arguing in a particular way and where are they coming from, you have to go to the philosophy of science, I would say. So what is the underlying philosophy that these people are putting forward? And I would say that most economists don't even understand the philosophy of science that they're using. They really do not realize what they're doing. And the same, I think, is in the degrowth community as well. So a more radical alternative, ecological economists do not understand how they're arguing and why they're arguing the way they do. So when you start looking at this, you can say, okay, so what are mainstream economists really claiming that we should say is a scientific knowledge claim? And what they're saying is there is a truth, an absolute truth out there, and that we can get to this truth by making foundational assumptions, and then we can build from those assumptions to make deductions about reality. And this is, they're then setting up everything they do on the basis of foundational assumptions. Mm-hmm. I was reading this article from the early 70s by Tobin and Nordhaus, and they're writing on economic growth and how we should include environment. It's very dismissive of the environment. The interesting thing I noticed was in about 80 pages of text, they have 69 occurrences of the word if this, if that, if this. What does that mean? That's an indication that they're making assumptions continuously that are dubious, totally dubious, and are quite often very ad hoc. So the foundationalism, the philosophy of science for a foundationalist science is that your truth claims are only valid if your foundations are truthful. And it's a kind of it's a loop, right? Because how would you ever know your foundations were truthful in the first place? So foundationalism is very flawed. Okay. It also claims that there's an objective truth. So if you go down the empiricist route, the objective truth would be, I can go out there and I can just measure stuff. Right, and I can tell you the relationships. So you take something like the classic land, labor, and capital. Oh, okay, we're going to go out there and measure land, labor, and capital and stick it in a production function. Okay, define land, labor, and capital for me. Well, you can't. So, you get the Cambridge capital controversy that goes on for 20 or 30 years, and economists between MIT and Cambridge in the UK cannot agree on how to measure artificial capital. Real, capital. It's a problem. It cannot be measured in the way that they need to do it. So you have a real issue, I think, underlying the philosophy of science. There, the philosophy, your knowledge claims are flawed. So then you get to the postmodern kind of reaction to this. Economists and other scientists are making claims about truth. It's what we call naive objectivism. So they're making claims that are naive, and they're saying they're objective, but actually, there's an awful lot of sociology in here. So we could say, well, there's a group of scientists making claims, and they get together and they come up with rules about how we should operate. And as we were discussing earlier, they chuck people out, they turn their backs on things, and so on. So the postmodernist critique of science was very much that there's a sociology of science as well, and that there is an element in which we bring people in and they create a discourse. So then discourse becomes very, very prevalent in terms of how we should understand science. The problem here is that it's not just about discourses. This is very, very current. And we were talking about communication earlier. Everybody thinks, if we change the discourse, we'll change the world. I'm sorry, you won't. There's a role for communication and discourse in society, but reality is also very material, very structured. There's an infrastructure, there's a lot of other things besides a discourse in society. And changing discourse is not going to change anything about the environment. What we need to do is actually change the reality of the structures of what we're doing, the production processes, the way that we transport, eat food, and so on and so forth. So there is a reality. Having said that, of course, discourse in human society is part of social structure. And how we relate to the world is clearly through language. But that's conceptualization. It's not just a discourse, it's how we conceptualize things. So what you get to is, okay, there's the naive objectivists who claim that there's an absolute truth. We reject that.
Okay.
There's the postmodernists who claim that everything's a discourse. We reject that. But both of them have got elements which we might want to take on board. We are concerned about truth, but we don't have to say that truth is absolute and objective in that sense. We are concerned about discourse in society as part of social structure and how we conceptualize. Okay, so we can take that from the postmodernists. And we also can accept that there is a social structure to science, but there's also a reality to science. So what we really want is to combine understanding reality, conceptualization, and knowledge of how social structures are operating in society. And that's why you end up with something that is critical and realist.
I'd love to unpack that a bit more. I'm wondering if it would be helpful to give an example. So maybe if I can put one out there and then you can tell me if I'm going on the right track or if I've completely gone wrong. On the objective and the absolute truth, there was an example that I really liked in John Harvey's book, which I think is quite a common one that's used, which is if a tree falls down in the forest and no one is around to hear it, did it make a noise? The idea there, if I've understood correctly, is that, well, we, our perception, we have ears that allow us to hear certain things, but not all beings perceive sound in that way, or it could be through vibration. So that is not a absolute truth, but there is an element of truth to it. I don't know if I've gotten completely wrong there.
Yeah, okay. So what I would say is that that kind of example is used to criticize empiricism.
Yeah.
So empiricism claims that the only truth is things that we observe and measure.
Yeah.
So if a tree falls down and makes a noise or does whatever, and no human sees it, then you say, oh, well, it never happened because it's not empirical. But this is the problem with empiricism, that it makes this claim. Now, what we understand, it's not that when a tree falls down, this is the problem with not getting to structure. If we go to the forest and we find a tree has fallen down, we can infer that when that tree fell down, it made noise. How do we make that inference? Because we understand the structure of a tree, and we understand what happens when trees fall over due to understanding structure. We do not have to observe everything to understand truth and make inferences about what happens. And this, of course, is the fallacy of an empiricist approach, which we have today. So, you know, in public policy, they're always talking about evidence-based science. Evidence-based science will have absolutely nothing to say about climate change, because we'll have to wait until the world is FUCK'd before we could actually get anywhere to an empiricist truth about climate change. And what do climate scientists do? You know, I had this debate with Helga Kommkolb, who's an Austrian leading climate scientist, and she said that they are doing empirical science to establish climate change. And I said to her, no, you're not, actually. Climate scientists don't do this, and you should know this. This is bad philosophy of science. Because what they actually do is they create climate models. They understand the structure of the climate. It's been understood since the late 1800s, right? The greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm.
That is a structure. It's not about observing. It's about understanding structure and then making predictions about what will this structure do if we chuck a bunch of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into it. We understand the structure. We don't have to observe it. We know that if you do that, the structure is going to do this. And this is just like basic scientific understanding. So the downplaying of structure and the reality, the ontology, as we call it, the real world, is the real problem. You don't have to observe the tree to know it made a noise. We know that's what happens when trees fall over.
And I think I'm conscious of time. I find this fascinating. I hope our listeners will too. It feels to me like sometimes this has been also a delay tactic. Like, as you said, you know, we have to measure it. This was a critique against the limits to growth as well. That was actually one of the big critiques that I interpreted from my research into that, was like, how can you say this is going to happen? Things like carbon pricing or the cost benefit analysis that you mentioned, one of the key tools used by environmental economists that have gone in the vein of William Nordhaus, spending, you know, so much time and effort trying to calculate what is the social cost and tying themselves in knots, I think, with the ethical implications of even trying to translate the damages into costs. What do you think of that? Is that a fair assessment of where that leads us to?
Yeah, so there's different issues that you're kind of implicit in what you've just said. If I started with the Meadows kind of approach, right, the interesting thing is that the mainstream economists are doing abstract deductive modeling. So they're actually doing what they criticize. So if they criticize the Meadows approach for being a abstract model, is totally contradictory, because the entire neoclassical mainstream is an abstract model with no relationship actually to reality, and it's not empiricist either. So, you know, that's a starter. We could start there. Okay, then you say, okay, so what do we do about the future? We can't observe the future. What you do with empiricism is you observe the past. Mm-hmm. It's all about the past. It's about what happened in the past. And we know that the past is not a good guide to the future. It doesn't tell us about catastrophes and so on. The Meadows report was basically saying, if we look at the structure and we say this is going to continue exponentially, then this is what we would predict to have. And they are aware that you have strong uncertainty, as I call it, which means you cannot predict. So what you do is you do scenario analysis. Scenario analysis is not a strange thing. You know, it was pushed forward by both the military and the corporations to make predictions about the future potentialities. It's actually a totally logical approach to use. So, you know, there's a lot of fallacies in there. But then you move on to, okay, so if we start measuring stuff, the thing is that the cost-benefit approach, the origins of it came out of this idea that rather than reducing pollution to nothing, if we were to try to do that, we would lose lots of benefits. So therefore, there are benefits and costs involved in any action, and we should try to take these into account. But as you pointed out, very quickly, the environmental economists, like my supervisor, Ralph Dodge, realized this raises all sorts of ethical questions. But then they're kind of caught between not wanting to raise lots of ethical questions. I mean, the IPCC, I think it was the second assessment report, has a chapter on economics with Arrow and various other mainstream economists, where they actually say, when they're talking about discounting future generations, if we were to make an ethical decision here, wouldn't we have to make ethical decisions about everything? You know, this is, oh my God, how horrible. Now we're going to have to make judgments and ethical decisions. So instead, what they do is they leave it implicit. So all the ethical decisions are being made, but they're not discussing how. And clearly, economists have a very, very strong ethical position. They're consequentialists. The only thing they take into account is the consequences. They're instrumentalists. It has to have an instrumental element to it. It's got to be anthropocentric. They exclude the non-anthropocentric, and so on. So basically, what happens is a cost-benefit analysis is implicitly making ethical judgments. It's actually adopting a philosophy in terms of moral philosophy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this philosophy that it adopts is consequentialist. So when I was studying in the University of Wyoming, for example, where they developed contingent valuation method, they're very concerned about willingness to pay, willingness to accept, and so on. So there's major issues here. So what happens in the early 1990s, Exxon Valdez runs aground, spills oil all over the Alaskan coastline. Mm-hmm. There's a massive court case. There are potentially billions of dollars at stake in this court case. But Exxon is a very large corporation, one of the Seven Sisters, and it has billions to spend on a court case. So what happens in this is that the NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration in the US, starts having a blue ribbon panel to discuss the costs and benefits and starts looking at contingent valuation studies to do this. So suddenly this contingent valuation approach is accelerated into the limelight. Now, what comes out of this is that contingent valuation, if you were looking at it, they do studies on willingness to pay. Yeah. But actually, if you damage somebody, it should be about their willingness to accept compensation. So they're immediately into a conflict. What's the ethical position? How much should you compensate? On what basis do you compensate? How does money represent compensation, and so on? So the ethics comes to the front.
Can I just clarify on this contingent?
So contingent valuation, yeah. So what happens is that the economists very early on realized that they can't measure things in the marketplace. So the very early studies, like travel cost method, try to find something where there is somebody paying something. So you travel in a car to a national park, and I can look at how much time you took, how much petrol you spent, and so on. So then I say, okay, so you're prepared to pay this much to go to that national park. This is the kind of thing they do. But then they realize there actually aren't markets in most things that they can relate the environment to. So they come up with the idea that what we do is we directly ask people how much they're willing to pay for something. So I say, how much are you prepared to pay for one extra tiger in this national park? Mm. And this is contingent on the circumstances I describe. And therefore, it's a contingent valuation. So it's contextualized. So we have to set up a pseudo market and try to get you to pay something. And one of the big contentions when this was done was actually, why should I pay? If you kill all the tigers in a park, you should compensate me for taking something away from me, right? It's not about me paying. So there's immediately a contestation over, okay, is it willingness to pay or willingness to accept? This is an ethical issue. Mm. But the big ethics issues came out earlier was intergenerational with climate change. Very early on, people were realizing the way that economists are describing future generations and the impact on future generations raises ethical issues. And this is why this whole fallacious debate over discount rates became so central, because it's actually implicitly deciding whether the future has any weight at all in our decisions. And it's an ethical decision.
Yeah. It seemed to me with the discount rate, I mean, there's so many problems with these approaches. I mean, I think even if you took the willingness to pay, it's sort of who has the power to pay? And exactly, and are we talking about now, future generations? They don't have, what if you don't have the information? I don't know if the tiger's good for me. I don't know if I need a clean climate today. Fox News is telling me one thing. My neighbors tell me something else. But on the discount rate, it felt to me like the way that economists are kind of getting at, and it's important to note that that's still being used, that it's sort of, well, but all we're doing is we're putting the numbers together and we're giving the politicians the decision of what discount rate to make. So then it becomes democratic. Is that not the way that they sort of
this, of course, is a total fallacious argument as well, because the way you frame anything and present it clearly has already made a decision. The economists who are claiming that they're going out there measuring, this is naive objectivism. All I'm doing is going out there and measuring things and telling people the truth. Now, if we describe something, I'll give you an example, right? You're going to describe something as an economist. You're totally objective. You want to be totally neutral. And you go out there and you decide, I'm going to measure unemployment and see what causes unemployment. Who's unemployed? So I go out and I measure people who are unemployed, and I find out that there are lots of long-term unemployed people for reasons that have nothing to do with being lazy or anything else. They're actually discriminated against. They're usually people of color. They're immigrants. They're disabled, and so on. So there's many discriminatory factors in the labor market. All I've done is objectively describe what's going on in reality. I publish my report, I've suddenly undermined the Conservative government's policies in the United Kingdom, which claim that long-term unemployment are a bunch of lazy people who don't want to do anything, who are scammers, who are taking the welfare state for a ride, and so on. Mm. So my innocent descriptive research is heavily value-laden. But more than that, what it does is it criticizes a whole bunch of think tanks and institutions in society that are pervading lies about society. So you can't even do descriptive, objective research without having value implications. And I would go even further and say the implications of research like that mean that the person who does the research actually has a responsibility for doing something about it. If that's what you discovered, then you better start becoming an activist about unemployment and the way that people are treated to become a social activist. And it's the same with the environment.
And so, and yet some people would say that scientists shouldn't be activists.
Yeah, but this is, again, highly problematic, right? So you take something like, say we take Hansen, who was in NOAA, you know, in the...
James Hansen. Yeah.
So you take James Hansen, he's doing climate research. He's very much in the naive objectivist camp of science. He believes in the late 80s that his science, because it is factual and correct, will actually make the United States government implement a policy that will control greenhouse gases. The man couldn't be more naive if you asked. I mean, it's really amazing that anybody would be so naive to really believe this. Basically, you know, what he's asking in 1989 is for the total deconstruction of the capitalist fossil fuel economy. And he doesn't even realize it. But he's doing testifying in front of the Congress, the Senate in the United States. It's hitting the headlines and everything. And he just sticks to his guns on his science, right? There's nothing wrong with that in one sense, but it's totally naive. And of course, what happens later is that he becomes an activist because the man has some ethical values, right? He actually understands that it's wrong for him to suppress his information. It's wrong for him to deny that there is climate change. It's wrong for him to deny the implications of it. Therefore, he has to actually do something about it. You know, science has implications for society. Technologies are not neutral, for example. You know, scientists who are doing supposedly objective research on new technologies are implementing things that have all sorts of implications for society and the structure of society. You know, whether it's our television, mobile phones, jet planes, or nuclear weapons. They all have implications. These are not neutral things.
Yeah, so maybe we can pick up on the activist part. So you can bring this to an area of activism, we say, or one our movement. You mentioned degrowth before. Could you maybe talk about then the importance as well of that movement? Like you say, we've discussed that science is political. There are reasons why certain strands of economics have become dominant and others not. And degrowth developed as a movement kind of against, if I understand correctly, against the kind of the growth paradigm. Can you talk a little bit about how you define degrowth and also the importance or the relative importance of the movement?
Yeah, so degrowth is interesting because it's originally, as I argue, it's got diverse roots, but I would argue that it has a core in an understanding of science and limits. Mm-hmm. And it has a connection to the work of Georgescu Rogan, for example, and entropy and the kind of basic laws of physics and the implications for the economy. Having said that, it's also very diverse and it involves political activists and people who are not scientific in that sense, people who do believe that we can change the world through changing the discourse, you know, which we were discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. And they think that if they can get the language changed in society, that then the direction of the society will change. So degrowth has got different elements to it. Degrowth is also, because of that initial limits aspect to it, is quite often caricatured, I would say, as being about a downturn in growth, which is not what degrowth has really, I think, substantively ever been about. Substantively, it's about a different type of society or different type of societies where the structures of the society are such that you don't pursue growth, you don't pursue the more, you pursue a more meaningful life. And then there's a whole range of what is that meaningful life about? And this is where we get into alternative societies, alternative structures, solidarity, community, caring, and then into philosophies about what would alternative communities be like. So what I see with degrowth in one respect is that it gets caricatured as just a downturn in the economy, which is actually a recession, you know, and it's not about a recession. It's about the structure. And even some of the leading people in degrowth, or the loudest voices, we could say, not sure if they're leading, but they're certainly very loud. And they will argue positions which actually maintain a capitalist structure and talk about degrowth being like reducing the hours of work within a capitalist structure. But actually, degrowth is about changing the structure. It's not about the hours of work within capitalism. You know, that's just a reformist agenda, and degrowth was a much more radical agenda. So the other thing with degrowth, I think, is that it has been very useful because it's a social movement, I would say. It's not a science, but it's has bases in science. So what it does is it brings together a lot of very diverse people who have solidarity around certain value issues. They recognize society is going in the wrong direction, capitalism is not helping, has created lots of harm socially and ecologically, that growth, the growth economy or growth mania, as Mission called it, it needs to be deconstructed, taken apart, and we need a different direction. So it has to have a very, very strong anti-growth element and an anti-capitalist element, I would say, is part of degrowth and what degrowth is about. At the same time, degrowth has then got into problems, I would say. So I wrote an article, What's Wrong with Degrowth, trying to discuss some of these issues, which is about creating too broad an agenda, trying to pull in people who actually are pro-growth in some elements, you know, whether it's for development of developing countries or wherever, which means that they end up being pro-growth, pro-capitalists, which is a problem. And then that being justified as being tolerant and pluralist. Well, this is where I go back to science, right? We need a scientific basis for our activism. Activism still has to understand, what are the causal relationships? What is it that's causing things to go wrong? Why do we want to have some kind of a movement like degrowth, which doesn't, if it doesn't understand anything about what the structure of society is or how to address it? Clearly, you have to have a scientific understanding. So I think these are the elements. But the nice thing about degrowth was it actually helped to stimulate, I think, more radical thinking. Mm-hmm. And I feel that eco-economics was actually atrophying to some extent in the same way that environmental economics did in the past, before degrowth started, which is why I've always supported degrowth as a social movement and find it a very good community to engage with, because it stimulates thinking and it stimulates more radical thinking. And it is an outlet for academic activism as well, which is important.
On activism, maybe I can ask as well about your experience here, where we should have met and or we have met, but not to do this interview, is in Vienna when you were heading up the Masters in Social and Ecological Economics and Policy at the Vienna University of Business and Economics. And I recall a newspaper article, I think it was a protest at the university around the closure of a library. Can you talk about the context of that, and then maybe also more broadly what it's like right now in the university to get these more, this, to advance the science that, as you're trying to do with this book, Fight for Revolutionary Change? How's it going? What needs to happen?
Yeah, so the issue at the university, at the Wirtschafts University in Vienna, was that the election of a rectorate took place. Rectors are usually appointed on the basis of a vote of the students and the staff, who send an indication of who their preferred candidate is from those who are on the ballot. Mm-hmm. It's highly unusual for this to be ignored. In this case, they appealed to a body that was set up outside the university, actually under the extreme right-wing government of 20 years ago, and this legislation was never reversed. And this body, this quango outside body, has the power to appoint the rector. So they ignored the internal people and they appointed. So the preferred candidate was a critical of mainstream economics, more of a social economist.
Okay.
And the person they appointed was the head of department of the economics department, a totally mainstream orthodox economist. So once you had this economist as the rector, what does he start doing? He starts basically shutting things down. So what he did was he shut down the library of the socioeconomics department. The Wirtschafts University is very interesting. It has an economics department and it has a socioeconomics department. Yeah. And this is another story because the previous rector, before these guys, two previous rector, he was head of the economics department, became the rector. And after you've been rector, you will go back to your department, possibly. They usually go on to greater things somewhere, which he did. But he was thinking he didn't want to go back to the economics department. He wanted to have a socioeconomics department. So he created one. So he actually set up the socioeconomics department. So now you've got economics department, socioeconomics department, right? And now what happens is the rector becomes the economist. So he doesn't like the socioeconomics department. Clearly, he shuts down the library. So basically, it's done under all sorts of guises. Oh, we need more lecture rooms. We need this, that, the other. But the bottom line is they closed down the heterodox, the heterodox institute. They shut down the library for the socioeconomists and they discriminate against it. So that's the point there. This is a long-running kind of battle of heterodoxy versus orthodoxy. You know, Fred Lee wrote a book about this, documenting the way that different departments were shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very well-known kind of issue that goes on all the time. And it's also something I've written about in my book in terms of eco-economics, the fight with the mainstream and continuously having them encroach into heterodoxy, taking over, removing professors, so on.
Yeah.
So activism, right? So that was just a small local kind of issue. Activism, I think, is more serious is when we get to civil disobedience, when we start talking about to what extent can we challenge the power structures in societies which are becoming increasingly undemocratic, where civil protest is being discriminated against. You know, the United Kingdom has become really awful. The outlawing of organizations, on Palestine, the imprisonment of people in arbitrary ways. But even in the, earlier times, it's now come out that they had already planted people inside environmental NGOs. So you have really awful cases where, these undercover agents are sleeping with activists and having children with them and this kind of thing. I mean, it's been a long running and very awful kind of struggle. But therefore, I think there are serious and very legitimate grounds for civil protest and activism. It depends also which society you're in. So even though the way things are going is pretty awful, we are still in societies that have some elements of democracy. I wouldn't call them democracies myself, but they have elements of democracy and also liberty, which is being reduced all the time. But if you're in a totalitarian dictatorship, if you're in China, if you're in, Saudi Arabia, or if you're in the United States today, you're going to suffer in very strong ways, right? So what do you do under such regimes? I'm not going to give you any answers. I'm just saying that there are grounds in which you have to actually struggle against powers that be when you don't have power.
Mm.
And ultimately, of course, you can get to the stages where people are engaged in revolutionary acts and revolutions of different sorts occur, whether it's like velvet revolutions or armed revolutions. And it depends on the context, I think. The bottom line for me, though, is that from a scientific perspective, is that what are the causes that create a society and how can you actually change what supports a bad society? So as long as we have the mechanisms of, say, law, constitution, civil protest, civil rights, and so on, we have the opportunity to use mechanisms that don't require extreme violence and so on. If those mechanisms are removed from society, then you end up with civil war.
In terms of where we go, and maybe bringing it back slightly to, so that one of the reasons that I wanted to create this podcast and hopefully a documentary is that I feel like the economics as it is taught and practiced today is legitimizing the current system and holding it up. And I think for all the discussion we had at the beginning about the more populist texts that are critiquing economics maybe without as much of a scientific basis, they have opened up a lot of people to alternative ideas, including myself. And now I'm going around the route of trying to fill in the gaps and get a better education on it. So thank you for your work in that. But one of the points I tried to make to people that are maybe a little bit newer or you have read some of these popular texts that we've discussed is they quite often don't realize how far away we are from that in the sciences. They think that, oh, they see maybe there's a master's at the VU where you were teaching and this is now on the textbooks everywhere, this is on the curriculum everywhere. And they don't realize actually in some cases, as you've just described, we're even going backwards, we're suppressing it more. So I guess maybe how important do you think this is? Should we continue the fight? I don't know what you're doing in Norway now. Do you want us to be out with this? And you know, is that something, or I guess you do to an extent, or you wouldn't have written the book, but
yeah.
I guess to what extent do you think it is important that we fight within the universities? And if so, what could other people do? We've talked about other types of activism, but maybe on the university side, I'd like to hear what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, I think so. These are not mutually exclusive. I think you have to be active at all levels. Right?
Okay.
And so the thrust of my life's work, if you like, is not on the activist front. I do activism. I do civil disobedience and various other things, and I have done, you know, throughout my life. But my core is actually to change ideas in society. I strongly believe that misconceptualizing the world as is being done has tremendous damage, both socially and ecologically. So we have to reconceptualize how we understand. And this is reconceptualizing not just in terms of the academic, but the academic has to feed into practice. So my concern is, how do we take the ideas from, like my book is very philosophical and academic, and move them into practices? So we need to get to the element of practice. But my thrust is to change economics. So, you know, my real push is that economists are actually misleading the world into a total disaster. And they should not be pretending that they're doing anything different, and that we need to make this very, very obvious to everybody. My concern on the communication front is I'm totally in favor of artistic expression, communication, populist writings, and so on. What I don't like is when populist writings pretend to be scientific. That's what I just really don't like. So I have no problem with people writing books which communicate things in a populist way. I still want to have coherence, and I still want to have underlying scientific aspects to these things. So, you know, if I were to take something like the donut, I think it's misleading. That's the problem I have with it. Now, many people like yourself get introduced into these, into the ideas, and they go deeper with it. But most people I know see that diagram, never read the book, understand very little, and you have to question, so what is this actually doing? What is the role of these images in society? You know, how many people does it really empower to do what you're doing, as opposed to just they say, oh, Kate Raworth's got the donut thing. We don't have to worry about the environment and social issues anymore. That's good. You know, I fear that can happen. So my concern is really we do have to fundamentally change ideas. Now, when we get to the universities, clearly there's funding issues. There's things, again, about democracy here. So suppression of critical thinking is very current. The suppression of critical thinking comes from the extreme right. And I'm sorry to say, it also comes from the pluralist kind of postmodernist side, which is quite on the left as well. So being able to criticize scientifically and reject ideas is quite often seen as unacceptable. Oh, we should be tolerant and pluralist. Well, I'm sorry, that's an idea of political tolerance, which I'm totally in favor of political tolerance, right? But I'm not about saying the earth is flat is just as valid as the earth is round, you know, which is what they're arguing. Mainstream economics is basically telling us the earth is flat and we all know it's round. So it's like, you know, this is the kind of fallacious debates that we get into. So I think that, you know, the big issues around the way that universities are running is that they have to be independent. They have to have independent funding. They should not be controlled politically, that there should be fair elections of things like rectors. So the example I gave you earlier is totally biased top-down and has nothing to do with elections or representation. There's a lot of issues about the way that curriculum is controlled, especially in economics. There is really a suppression. This is why heterodoxy got going in the very first place, because heterodox economists had to organize themselves as a separate, distinct society. They tried within the Royal Economic Society. There were big pushes to try to reform it, and they got so frustrated by being pushed back, they just ran a parallel conference. They started running parallel conferences and organizing themselves, and then it grew from there. And then they're like, well, okay, why do we even bother with these mainstream people? And that's been my position. I spent 20 years in environmental resource economics. I was involved in the European Society. I was running their newsletter at one time, and it goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. You know, how many mathematical models can you deconstruct? You know, it's a farce. I go to an international conference and you have economists putting up mathematical models on climate change, which was my specialization. I did my PhD on it. And they're putting up these models. And I know those models, and everybody who's in the room knows, would take you a week to understand.
Yeah, yeah.
So just because someone sticks this up and says blah, 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 and there's the conclusion, nobody understands that in the room. It's a total farce, right? It's just a game. Because it's not about science at all. That's what we need to deconstruct. We want real science here. So there's a really, you know, there is a really important role to be played in exposing the fallacies that are going on around scientific claims. That's why the book has got, you know, a lot of philosophy of science, as we were discussing earlier. It's really important that people understand that when people make knowledge claims, what is the basis that they're actually founding that claim on? Naive empiricism, naive objectivism. Is it that? Is that what's going on? Yes, it is. And in which case, you don't have to get a PhD in economics to deconstruct this. This is what I told my master's students. Don't worry that you aren't an economist. You don't have to be an economist to deconstruct an economist, because their basic philosophy of science and the fallacy of their arguments is so obvious once you study it, you know, as you're aware, that you don't actually have to get into all the detail of the mathematical model and whether they've included this variable or that variable, or, you know, how they did their econometrics 20,000 times with a computer. It's irrelevant, because they're not even answering the basic questions. You just say, you know, if I was talking to a post-Keynesian economist, a leading post-Keynesian who has textbooks, and I said to him, can you define work for me? Define work. He couldn't do it. We spend an hour over dinner discussing work. But at the end of it, he still couldn't define it. You know, this is the problem. Money supply. What's money supply? Now, we're talking about basic conceptualizations of central concepts in the theories. Because they don't have any science, the philosophy of science. They, you know, what are you actually doing?
You write, you know, about the importance for clarifying division and seeking unity. I wonder how we can seek unity. And as you write, and as I've also discovered, I think that, you know, there's a lot in the heterodox schools, it would seem, that is useful. I don't know. I don't think we're going to have the answer today, but I'm just wondering.
I'll give you the answer.
Okay, great. You have the answer. Because, perfect.
Because
what's the answer?
At the end of the day, there is a structure, there is a reality. So the point of emphasizing the science is that we have to look at the object that we're studying, and the object of study will tell us whether we're getting things right or not. And then we put practices in place and we see, okay, is the practice working? Does the practice work? Is my knowledge adequate for the thing that I want to do? Do I have a good explanation? Do I understand the causal relationships? And it's very clear to me that the unity that we're searching for is a unity around a common understanding of the way that reality is structured. And that's why the science is important. And then on the kind of more postmodern side, we can say we have to conceptualize. So we need to get to what I call in the book common denominator concepts. So we can unify around common understandings of reality, which doesn't change. The reality is there, right? The social structure is there. It's not changing rapidly at all. You know, we have this very powerful social structure that has been there in basically the same form for a couple of hundred years. It's called capitalism. and we can study it and we can understand it. And there's lots of understanding about this. The divergences come not actually quite often with the ontology, with the understanding of the reality, but with what we should do about it. And that's more. Right. So then you get like some of the things I point out in the book are divisions within the heterodoxy about whether you keep the system and reform it or we change the system. And this should be a resolvable debate to some extent over understanding causal mechanisms. So what are the causal mechanisms? So if you take something like the leftist pro-growth position, they think that they can control capitalism, make it into state capitalism, and just do income redistribution. I would argue against this because I think if you maintain capitalism, implicit in it is exploitation, and all you do is offshore your exploitation to third world countries. So, you know, we're all very nice and happy in England because we can redistribute, but we're exploiting everybody else in South America and India, Africa, and Eastern Europe, and wherever, you know. So I don't think it works. But this is actually something that you can study and understand, and we can actually, if we had open debate in society, could get to a point where we could resolve a lot of these issues. So I think there's also this unity there. I also talk about pre-analytic visions, and the pre-analytic vision is really our understanding of the reality. You know, why are people in degrowth, donut, ecological, economic, socially economics? They have common ground, right? There is common ground in terms of our pre-analytic vision of what's wrong with society, the way we understand society. So there is a unity there of that aspect, you know? So I think that the bottom line is we are studying a social ecological system, and that structure is there, independent of us, and therefore we can come to a common understanding by studying it.
Thank you, Clive. I might come back to you on some of these topics. I am tempted to put together something on your work on philosophy of science for this project. I do think it needs to be communicated, yes. But it has to be scientifically grounded. So there's a challenge I've set myself. Thank you. This was really insightful. I'll let you get back to your eco-village in Norway and hope maybe to see you live at some point. But thank you again for your time, Katie. Clive.
You've been listening to Invisible Handcuffs, Unchaining Economics, hosted by me, Katie Shields, with music, art and production by Philip Melchers. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider liking and following us on YouTube or your favourite podcasting platform, and by subscribing on our website at invisiblehandcuffs.com. where you can also find the show notes to this episode and more about the project. With that, thank you for listening, and I hope to see you next time.